Good morning. It's Monday, May 6th. The war in the Middle East is now 213 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FTD Morning Brief. I'm still juggling here. The news on campus is just too relevant to ignore, but the news out of the region is no less compelling. If you don't follow me on X, find me at Jay Schanzer and check out my take on the campus chaos and the potential terrorist connections. Our guest on today's episode is Roya Hakakian. She's a brilliant scholar of Iranian origin. And in our conversation, you'll see that she has things to say about what's happening on campus. Her view of those protests is something I've not heard elsewhere. So hang on for a few minutes. We'll get to her shortly. First, some analysis and headlines on the war overseas. President Biden reminds me of the Dutch boy from that Hans Brinker story who plugs a hole in the dike with his finger. Biden has tried to prevent Israel from fighting the wider war that Iran has been waging against it for 7 months. From day one, he's restrained the IDF from hammering Hezbollah in Lebanon. He stopped the IDF from a wider attack on Iran after that missile and drone barrage in April. And since Ramadan, he's prevented the IDF from entering the last bastion of Hamas in Rafah. Well, yesterday, there were more cracks in the dike. Hamas fired 10 rockets at the Kerem Shalom crossing on the edge of Gaza, killing 4 Israeli soldiers. Then Hezbollah fired 100 rockets at Israel, the single largest rocket salvo since it started attacking Israel on October 8th. Israelis have had it. Understandably so, the IDF has now ordered the evacuation of Rafah, and the White House doesn't like it. American politics undeniably influenced the president's calculus. The campus protests, where he's called Genocide Joe, haven't helped. But I must ask, is there more to Biden's fears beyond the messy politics or bad PR? Because I'm watching the White House policy right now, and I'm deeply alarmed. Biden has reportedly cut off ammo deliveries to Israel. How long will that last? What happens if a northern front erupts while Israel is fighting in Rafah? This is a dangerous moment. Israel appears isolated. Israel's enemies are cheering that. And at least for now, the White House appears to be part of the problem, not the solution. Now for your headlines. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman al-Safadi, is calling for sanctions against Israel. This is insane. Safadi is the foreign minister of a moderate Arab country that enjoys a peace agreement with Israel, and that peace agreement ensures that Jordan receives money, water, gas, intelligence, and other military assistance. He is simply off his rocker, if you ask me. So why is he doing this? Well, for one, it plays well amongst the 80%+ of the Jordanians who are of Palestinian origin. But Safadi also says Israel has imposed a famine on Gaza. Look, I'm not going to tell you that things in Gaza are rosy. They aren't. But look at the massive amount of aid trucks and the U.S. pier, the Cyprus aid channel, the airdrops, including from Jordan and the UAE. There is a massive amount of humanitarian activity in Gaza. Safadi has lost his marbles, folks. Jordan's foreign minister sounds no different than the foreign minister of Iran or the spokesman for Hamas, for that matter. Headline two, Israel has finally done it. Al Jazeera has been closed. Police seized broadcast equipment. The website is blocked. The office in Jerusalem is shuttered. Cell phones were confiscated too. Israeli media aired video footage of the raid. Communications Minister Shlomo Karhi made an appearance. Al Jazeera will remain shut down in Israel for 45 days pursuant to the Knesset law that authorized the move. We've talked about it here before. This is not a freedom of speech thing. The Israelis have found multiple Al Jazeera journalists that were moonlighting for Hamas. Or maybe it was the other way around. Let's not forget that Qatar owns Al Jazeera. Qatar also funds Hamas, not to mention a gaggle of other terror groups around the Middle East. So now for the interesting part. Let's see how Qatar responds. And headline three. Today is Yom HaShoah in Israel, Holocaust Remembrance Day. I raise this for a specific reason. This is not ancient history for Israelis. The Holocaust is something raw and still remarkably fresh for the remaining survivors, but also their children and grandchildren. People in Israel still talk about October 7th as the deadliest day for the Jewish people since the Holocaust. This in part explains their tenacious and unwavering desire to finish off Hamas once and for all. It also explains the fury they experience when people out there try to deny what happened on 10/7. Holocaust denial is a thing. And so is 10/7 denial, too. People say it all the time. The reason for Palestinian-Israeli conflict's intractable character lies in the sense of victimhood on both sides. I'm not sure I buy that. The reason this conflict is so intractable is that the Israelis refuse to die quietly. As much as their enemies want to drive them out, the Israelis simply have nowhere to go. All right, it's time to hear from Roya Hakakian. Born and raised in Iran to Jewish parents, she came to this country in 1985. She's the author of several books, including Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, which is a gripping account of the assassination of four Kurdish activists in Germany by the Iranian regime. Roya is a scholar today at the Moynihan Center. I caught up with her over the weekend in New Haven, where she is also a fellow at Yale University's Davenport College. Here's my interview with her about Iran, Hamas, and the campus protests, just for you here on the FDD Morning Brief. Welcome, Roya Hakakian.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Really great to have you with us. I want to start with a nice softball for you. Tell us a little bit about your book, Journey from the Land of No. And to take it maybe a step further, what has the journey been like for you leaving Iran, living in the West, especially now during a time of nuclear appeasement? And then after that, I mean, we're looking at 7 months of war.
Yes. I guess the best way to talk about that book is to talk about its opening chapter, which is about a conversation I was having in real life with a New York Times editorial writer who at the time, which is about 1999, was fascinated with the rise of Mohammad Khatami to power in Iran and the start of the infamous reform movement. And this reporter was asking me, reform is coming to Iran, do you believe it? And so I take the entire book to respond to that very question. And, the, you know, as you can guess, my answer in 1999 was that the reforms are not going anywhere. And my reasons were kind of recounted in every chapter, basically in the fact that a regime that relies on a supreme leader cannot know of change, cannot transform itself. And at the time, it was only intuition, but of course, in the passing of years, and especially in 2009, it became incredibly clear that the regime was unreformable. So as far as Iran is concerned, in a way, I came with the same beliefs that I had 30 plus years ago. And unfortunately, the events between Iran and the United States and Iran and elsewhere haven't proven me that I have been wrong.
Nope. I think you've been right all along. And to be a skeptic of this regime in Iran, I don't know why it seemed so counterintuitive to some a few years ago. Hopefully this has been a wake-up call. But let me just actually pull on that thread a little bit more. You wrote an article shortly after the outbreak of the war about the ideological similarities between Hamas and Iran. If you would just maybe tell us a little bit about that, and has anything changed as the war has progressed? I mean, would you make additional arguments at this point? Has anything come out that maybe surprised you?
Yes. Well, let me answer the first part of the question, and then I'll get to the surprise. Which is that everything about October 7th, everything about the way in which the terrorists went into the kibbutzim in Israel, everything about the way they treated the women, and even the slogans, the way they were manhandling women and others, were very reminiscent of 1979 in Iran for me and thereafter. I mean, it is no accident that, you know, everybody was chanting Allahu Akbar, or, you know, people keep saying to me that these are, you know, sacred Muslim incantations. But there's a reason why when they're exercising violence that those words of incantations occur to them. It had the look, it had the markings, it had the sounds that I remembered from a long time ago. And of course, you know, we all know that Iran has been helping Hamas, both financially and otherwise. But the part that has surprised me, which really shouldn't have in certain ways, is the way Iran had, in terms of its ideology, has really infiltrated American campuses. The way in which, you know, the brightest minds of this country, not just the students, but also faculty and, you know, thinkers, are now saying that we should back Iran in the resistance that the Palestinians are putting up against Israel. And that just blows my mind. I mean, because it isn't just this October 7th, but we have a long history with Iran. We have, you know, 10 years of war with Iraq. We have, you know, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of instances of terrorism. We have the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. We have the unleashing of basically, you know, acts of terrorism throughout the world against so-called infidels that really began with that first fatwa. And then, you know, all the rest of it. And to think that there are people that after such a long span of time would still band themselves together with that regime is shocking.
I agree. Well, tell me, I mean, in terms of what you see on campus right now, I see the parallel that you're drawing, and I hadn't thought of it, but wow, that's something to think about here. Do you see any other signs that would concern you? You're on a campus yourself.
Look, I don't know if you saw, but I took the time, which I rarely do because I have a love-hate relationship with Twitter. I took the time to write a long tweet to say that the signs of 1979 or 1978 leading to 1979 is all over this, is all over these campus youth who are clearly secular, but have no inhibition in lining up against somebody who is leading prayers or repeating words in Arabic that they certainly do not understand. And that's another thing that I find terrifying, because secular Iranians in 1978, in 1977, in 1978, thought that all they needed to do was to use Khomeini, because Khomeini, they thought, could be manipulated. But at the time, they knew that he was the face that the public knew as the face of the revolution. So why not band with him and then discard him? You know, because they were the seculars, they were the smarter ones, they were the better equipped ones. And that certainly didn't turn out to be the case. So they didn't mind repeating the same words. They didn't mind embracing Khomeini's message at the time, thinking that, you know, a year later, when they are in power, Khomeini will be far away doing his religious studies. I see the secular students on campuses repeating the same mistake. I see the secular students thinking that there is a higher cause that they're fighting for. And if they need to show solidarity by acting like sheep, by saying things that they don't understand, by praying while they are either atheists or certainly not Muslims, they're just giving themselves over to the cause. And that I find incredibly dangerous.
Insightful. And again, something I had not thought about at all, but getting into the heads of these protesters, that's very interesting. Useful idiots, I think, is a term that comes to mind, but maybe a kinder way of putting it too. Let me shift gears a little bit, but still talk about protests. What about these protests that are ongoing in Iran right now? I mean, it strikes me that this is a real tool, quite mm-hmm. frankly, that could be used by the West to pressure the regime or even try to undermine it, bring it down. What's driving them right now? I mean, they do seem to be organic, and that is a good thing.
Yes, yes. So, you know, we were talking about American campuses and I was grim, and suddenly we talk about the protests in Iran and, you know, I feel uplifted, because I do think that, you know, in some ways, regardless of whether there is a change of regime in Iran, say this year or next year, or even the year after, the fact that this transformation has taken place inside Iran, the fact that Iran is the singular nation in all of the Middle East where there is no support for Hamas, in fact, there is objection to Hamas, where there is such a deep disbelief in the regime's propaganda that none of the demonstrations that you saw in other parts of the Middle East in support of October 7th attack took place in Iran is a major watershed transformation. And we have to come to the recognition, to the realization that whether or not things change in Iran, regime-wise, government-wise, something huge has taken place. And what is that? It is a whole generation of youth that no longer believes in the legitimacy of its leadership. It is a transformation that speaks of a whole new generation and, you know, perhaps even, you know, the generation that precedes it and succeeds it, that whatever propaganda that we thought 40 plus years of a religious theocracy would inculcate in them has not really spread roots. And that, in fact, they are aware of all the lies that they've been told about U.S. imperialism, about Israel, about, you know, the justifications that Hamas offers. So I think that's incredibly important. And I try to get people to see that regardless of what happens with the regime, that the huge change that we should want to see within an entire population has taken place. Now, whether or not, you know, the actual overthrow can come about, of course, as you said, entirely depends on whether the West decides to do the right thing and try to help and move things along. One of the things that really, really befuddles me is the fact that for over 20 years, the State Department has been through, you know, the Division of Labor, Democracy, and Human Rights, funding the various human rights, you know, democracy advocacy in Iran, among Iranians, right? So one would think that our own State Department, by funding these projects, does want to see change. But I've come to the conclusion that no, they don't, because, you know, the extent of their engagement is to just give out the funding. When the reality hits, as it did in during the, you know, Woman Life Freedom Revolution or uprising in Iran, there was no actual act to follow, to say, oh, you know, 20 plus years, we have been funding this initiative. So now the second phase is coming along. Now the, you know, funding that we had spent for so many years to bring about democracy has yielded benefits. And so let's push it to the next stage. But that doesn't seem to be part of the plan.
It's so interesting because, you know, you think about the State Department of the 1950s and the kind of adventurism that that State Department would engage in. And these are things that are still, of course, resented by some in Iran, that the State Department was so forward back then, but it's just so different now. It's like they've gone 180 degrees and they're so fearful of actually following through. But the other thing that you just mentioned to me that I think will stick with me is this idea of the protesters here in the United States sort of aligning themselves with Hamas and Iran, and then the protesters in Iran setting themselves against both of those, right? The Iranians and Hamas, the Iranian regime. Just really upside down stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. It, meaning that every truth that the world needs to know, and American students included need to know, is within Iran. And nobody is lending them an ear. Nobody wants to hear them.
Yep. Well put. Well put. We're going to leave it there. Roya Hakakian, thank you so much for joining the FDD Morning Brief.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Great conversation. Here's what FDD has on tap for you today. FDD resident scholar Ruel Markarek published a piece in the Washington Post with AEI's Gary Schmidt about the country of Georgia. Georgia has seen a massive protest movement emerge against the new foreign agents law that essentially hinders Georgia's Western integration and promotes Russian influence in its policies. Ruel and Gary argue that officials in Brussels and Washington must impose harsh sanctions against the country's ruling party to prevent things from deteriorating further. Over at FTD's Long War Journal, editor Bill Roggio dissects the baseless assertions made to Congress by Zalmay Khalilzad, a key figure behind the Qatar-brokered agreement that facilitated the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan in 2021. Get this. The former U.S. negotiator claims that thanks to the Taliban, al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan is a thing of the past. Yeah, let's just say Bill's not buying it, and neither am I. Zal is either fighting to preserve what's left of his shattered credibility, or he's a tool of the Qatari regime. Either way, yikes. And finally, director of FTD's China program, Craig Singleton, teamed up with Representative Rob Whitman, vice chair of the House Armed Services Committee, for an article in Defense News. They detail the recent docking of Chinese warships at Cambodia's Ream Naval Base. This is the first overseas naval presence for China in the Indo-Pacific region. Craig and the congressman argue that America must respond quickly. This move by Beijing is key to China's efforts to expand its global military footprint and to deter U.S. intervention in a potential Taiwan crisis. That's a wrap for today's show, folks. Read our expert analysis on our website, FTD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FTD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at FTD.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for another exciting episode of the FTD Morning Brief featuring Congressman Michael McCaul. He's chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm eager to get a download from him about how he views things in the Middle East right now. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FTD.